Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to residents of the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Juanita Stevenson.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and thank you for joining us today for Valley Edition. In today's program, correspondent Shelley Bronco reports on the challenges Clovis business owners face complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act 21 years after the law was passed. Plus, will Valley school districts face another round of budget cuts in December? Why officials say a new law could make it difficult for them to balance their budgets. And Arte America, when it comes to what's going on around town, this cultural arts center is thriving. And as always, we invite you to join in the discussion. The phone lines are open at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 1-800-224-8989. And you can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. We begin with our report from Shelley Bronco. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law, prohibiting discrimination against the disabled. It requires the removal of physical barriers in public places so the disabled can have full and equal enjoyment of community facilities. But in recent years, Clovis businesses have faced a surge of lawsuits for buildings that aren't up to ADA construction requirements. This has led to a heated debate within the community over the rights of the disabled and their survival of small businesses in the recession. Correspondent Shelley Bronco has this report.
Fresno law student Rochelle Taylor gets around in a wheelchair. She's on her lunch break from work, and she's just wheeled into a restaurant in a neighborhood shopping center.
You kind of learn how to scope out your route. It's almost like a chess game. You're constantly planning two steps ahead.
A few minutes earlier, Taylor tried to maneuver her wheelchair over bumpy, bright yellow pads on the sloping sidewalk entrance. They're supposed to help the visually impaired feel the slope with their feet, but Taylor says they make her life difficult. They have a name.
Truncated domes, if you notice the yellow slabs of like the little bumps, those are my nemesis. I can't stand them. They make my shoes fall off. They loosen the screws in my chair. Like if I'm going down a slope and they're at the bottom, my front wheel hits those and I go flying out of my chair.
A snowboarding accident at age 15 left her paralyzed in her lower body. Now 27 years old, Taylor has had time to come up with little tricks to move about in public. But what works for others, such as those truncated domes, doesn't always work for her. It's a theme that has divided the local disabled community after a recent string of lawsuits has called into question what constitutes equal public access for the disabled. Starting early last year, some 44 Clovis businesses were sued for not complying with laws designed to eliminate public barriers for the disabled. Since then, that number has risen to more than 60 lawsuits. They've forced some businesses to shut down for repairs. Shop owners say the lawsuits couldn't have come at a worse time because of the recession. Under state law and the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, businesses frequented by the public must provide equal access for the disabled. California building codes cover everything from wheelchair ramps to signs in Braille for the visually impaired. Tina Sumner is the Director of Community and Economic Development for the City of Clovis. She says measurement requirements for items such as bathroom mirrors and towel dispensers are so strict and precise that small business owners often believe it's impossible to achieve perfect compliance. That leaves them vulnerable to lawsuits. Each violation, even a seemingly minor one, carries a penalty of at least $4,000.
If you have the signage is incorrect, the signage is the wrong height. Paper towel dispenser is too high, the mirror is too high. The pipes under the sink aren't wrapped. I mean, it just goes on. And at $4,000, it adds up pretty fast.
Behind these recent lawsuits is San Jose attorney Randy Moore, who has filed them on behalf of Fresno County clients. He says he is fighting for the civil rights of the disabled. He believes business owners have no excuses because the ADA has been around since the early 1990s, so they've had plenty of time to comply.
We don't bring a lawsuit in every case. in many places that have what some people consider to be like a minor violation, such as an inch off of a mirror or something like that. We don't bring lawsuits based upon those types of things. At least historically, we've brought lawsuits when there have been 20, 30 or more violations.
Moore says he and his clients don't make much money from these cases, so it's not about profit. The people he represents are tired of not being taken seriously.
They'll tell you that they've tried for years to talk to people at the counters, talk to the people in the businesses, make a complaint to somebody, put things in writing, and nothing was ever done. What we know is that until you bring a lawsuit, nothing gets done.
Okay, how's the back on this? Is it about perfect?
The back's okay.
One of Moore's clients, Daniel Delgado, has a workshop off Highway 41 in the Madera foothills. It's where he fixes wheelchairs and other mobility devices. Delgado uses a wheelchair and says he's been treated badly by local businesses. He recalls trying to get help at a gas station.
I asked for permission for them to come down to help me operate the gas. The person in that property says, we are not going to do it, you do it. And I told them, it is a law. The law is that you're supposed to help us. And they said, nope. I said, well, let me talk to your manager. And they said, the manager's not here.
Local business owners are worried about their vulnerability. They say the laws are so tedious and conflicting that someone could find weaknesses even if an ADA specialist helped with the repairs. One Clovis business under fire is tobacco shop Cigars Limited. Owner Micah Johnson wasn't comfortable discussing the particular repairs he's made because of the lawsuit. He says businesses would make accommodations if they were simply asked to do so.
99% of businesses would handle that and just do it. But if they went to a lawyer and the lawyer decided to take a fee, in the first place, you're creating a bitter resentment for both parties, both the businesses and those that are in need of that type of accessory.
Legislators have taken notice of these lawsuits. A bill working its way through the House of Representatives would give sued businesses a grace period to make ADA modifications. Meanwhile, the city of Clovis is offering ADA workshops to help business owners become informed about the law. The city also offers consultations with ADA access specialists, plus matching loans of up to $10,000 to help with repairs. Rochelle Taylor believes many of these lawsuits are frivolous, even though she once came close to suing over access to her college dorm in San Diego before the school worked with her to make repairs.
I think we're in the middle of a budget crisis, and people need to be cognizant of that. And if something is just slightly out of code, I think that it's ridiculous that somebody would use that as their meal ticket.
Both sides say empathy for the disabled is still part of the culture, but a sense of independence is important for a disabled person's quality of life. It requires a delicate balance to respect the rights of everyone in a community. I'm Shelley Bronco.
Thank you, Shelley, for that report and for joining us in the studio today. Now, the ADA has been around for two decades. Why haven't local business owners made these changes?
I spoke to the Clovis Chamber of Commerce, and they said many business owners didn't know how extensive these requirements are, getting into height requirements for mirrors and so forth. And on the other hand, in the last few years, the city has these ADA workshops, and there's been outreach by the chamber, and the media has been covering this issue. So there's plenty of knowledge out there now in the Clovis business community. So the chamber says business owners have plenty of information to start making these changes. But in some cases, there have been people who leased building spaces, and they were sued rather than the building owners themselves.
Okay. So some business owners, for instance, if they just, you know, bought the building, may not be as aware of this issue as others.
In some cases, yes.
Why are the constructions, you know, in your report, you talked about them having to be so-so. Why are the requirements so specific?
They were designed to provide standards that can accommodate most disabilities. One example is Braille signs. They have to be placed, according to ADA requirements, 60 inches from the finished floor surface to the center of the sign. It's that specific in the law. And that's supposed to be a comfortable height for most people to reach, and it gives the visually impaired a standard height so they know when they go out in the public and to different businesses, they know where to reach out and feel for the Braille in most public places.
So can anybody sue a business for ADA violations? Because as you mentioned in your report, there has been a surge in them.
Right. Well, in 2009, there was a California Supreme Court case involving Del Taco Restaurant, and that had a significant impact on these types of lawsuits. In that case, which was Munson versus Del Taco, the court ruled that under California civil rights laws, anyone can sue for damages, whether the business's ADA violations were intentional or not. So it doesn't matter if the business owners were unaware of their ADA violations. Before this case, the courts looked at whether the violations were intentional, whether the business owners knew that they had these things. So that has created even more conflict among all the parties in this issue. And business owners say anyone can walk in, find a problem, and file a lawsuit. But advocates for the disabled say these are civil rights violations, so barriers have to be removed no matter who finds them.
Wow. Well, let's hope they can find some common ground. And thank you so much, Shelley, for that report. When Valley Edition returns, the Law Valley School District say could make it difficult for them to balance their budgets. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. Valley school districts have just completed a very challenging budget process, one that saw them lay off teachers, cut programs, and increase class sizes. Although the state didn't cut as much from education as first anticipated, many districts are still hurting. Others are trying to find ways to rehire some of the laid off teachers. But a last-minute bill added to the state's budget could make it even more difficult for districts like Fresno Unified to balance their budgets. And it's also leaving some teachers in limbo.
Do you want to play? Yeah. Okay. What do we want to play? Should we do blocks?
54-year-old Becky Pfeiffer loves being a grandmother. She also loves being a teacher.
I love teaching. I absolutely love teaching. I have been extremely blessed and fortunate to be in a profession that I love. I love getting up and going to work. I love being with the other students.
For the first time in her long career, Pfeiffer is faced with the very real possibility that she may not be going back to the classroom in the fall. On March 9th, Fresno Unified School Board members approved the layoffs of more than 100 teachers.
On an action to release temporary teachers, on a motion by Board Member Davis, seconded by Board Member Ryan, to release 73 temporary teachers at the...
Pfeiffer, a 22-year veteran with the district, was among those receiving pink slips.
For me, being comfortable with Fresno Unified for such a long time, and then to have that upset the apple cart, so to speak, it can bring a great deal of stress into your life.
For the past 5 years, Fresno Unified has been able to weather the budget storm and avoid teacher layoffs. But the state's financial woes eventually took its toll on the Valley's largest school district. Deputy Superintendent and Chief Financial Officer Ruthie Kento says Fresno Unified has suffered $144 million in cuts over the last 3 years, $56 million this budget year alone. The district was forced to make cuts.
We will end up in a situation where approximately 50 teachers will most likely be in a layoff situation. Right now, I believe the number is currently about 70 teachers are in a layoff situation, but we are working every day to bring teachers back.
Pfeiffer is optimistic she will be one of those called back.
For me personally, I don't ever think that there was a time that the district did not express to me that they were going to do everything they possibly could do with what they had in order to keep us or to bring us back if the layoff had to go through.
In the end, schools received more money from the state than first estimated. But that won't prevent all teacher layoffs. Kento says Fresno Unified is sticking with the budget it passed in June. She says the plan signed by Governor Brown is based on very optimistic projections for revenue, money that may not materialize.
forcing the state to make another round of cuts in December.
It will be very impactful if the very optimistic revenue projections that they have included in the budget do not come to fruition.
Another reason the district is being very conservative with its spending, the state's budget includes provisions to protect teachers, preventing any layoffs during the next fiscal year. Kento says the law puts districts in a very difficult position.
One of the main points of the budget bill is that there will be an automatic mid-year cut to K-12 education if these very optimistic revenue assumptions do not come to fruition. And without the ability to do any layoffs or to plan for a reduction in workforce in that regard, it will be very difficult for school districts to be able to make adjustments without really massively cutting into other services.
If the anticipated revenue does not come through, schools could be hit with another $1.7 billion in cuts. Now, joining me in studio to discuss the budget situation is Fresno County School Superintendent Larry Powell. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you, Juanita.
And we are also joined by Chris Lazardi-Frazier, Kern County Superintendent of Schools. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Larry, we'll begin with you. Now, although the schools ended up, you know, not taking the huge hit that they thought they were going to take, many are still struggling with their budgets.
This is a very difficult time for schools because the state legislature decided to do something that has never been done before, and that is to tell school districts to assume that their revenue was the same for this year coming up that they had last year, even if it's not. And so their planning had to be as if they're going to receive all of the money they had last year. Well, we know that's not the case. And then when you throw in trying to not lay off teachers as a rule that you have to follow, you have an assumption of money that's not there. You have no ability to lay off teachers. You're going to find a lot of districts that decide not to bring teachers back because they haven't decided yet if bringing them back is part of the rule of no layoffs. So it's a very tough time, and I think most districts that have any sense at all are going to be very conservative in what they do, especially since revenue projections in June, just this last month, were $300 million-plus less than what we thought they would be. So it's a tough and challenging time for school districts.
Well, you know, I think many in the state thought that this year, you know, legislators, we might be done with the fuzzy kind of math, but it seems like the budget was balanced again, anticipating something that may not be there.
Well, we have a new math, and it's kind of an interesting situation where, you know, the state legislature decides to vote for something that is absolutely a vapor and nothing solid to it whatsoever. And school districts have been the last point in the state that have balanced budgets, have balanced it this year and 2 years out. And now they're saying, in addition to that, you only have to worry about this year and not the 2 years out as well. We have done such a good job in K-12 education being prepared for the craziness of the budget situation that we face. And now it seems that the state wants us to do the same thing the state did, and they're going to do it at school districts, is do what you want and pretend that you have money. That doesn't make any sense at all, and it's very disappointing.
I would like to bring in Superintendent Frazier right now. First of all, before we talk about you know, your take on this budget process, you know, Kern County schools and a lot of schools, you all had to make some tough cuts anyway, didn't you?
They really did, and actually we've been cut the last 2 years, and so they initially really tried to keep the cuts away from the classroom, but in the last 2 years, that's been virtually impossible. And so this really is affecting the kids in the classroom. We really are offering fewer electives, fewer AP courses. It's directly impacting the kids, and that's what we've always tried to avoid. But because of the depth of the cuts in the last few years, it's been virtually impossible.
We have been talking about this last-minute addition to the bill that legislators passed. What are your feelings about that?
Well, you know, I think what's difficult is we were really hoping for the tax extension. Kern is very conservative, and so it's not that we want increased taxes, but this seemed like a good bridge in the revenues to allow us to make those kinds of adjustments outside of the education community to be able to not have to have this gimmick budget. But unfortunately, that did not occur. I will say that we are very pleased that at least the governor and his signing message allows school boards to really take a look at budgeting in a way that keeps their districts financially solvent. And that's really important because with local control, I think Larry mentioned, the idea of budgeting on fantasy numbers is just not something that we can do, particularly when we're talking about real life situations that our teachers and our students will have to actually live with.
Oh, no, one of the things that was added in this budget, and I think what really poses a challenge, is let's say, as you've already indicated, that the revenue doesn't come in December, and school districts are faced with making additional cuts, but at the same time, part of this provision also said that districts cannot lay off any more teachers this fiscal year. Now, what does that do to a district?
Well, in reality, although we in years past have had this August ability to lay off, most school districts have not utilized that because that's an incredibly short time period before school starts. So most school districts have already made those cuts with anticipation of the fact that the revenues would not be there. But there are a few districts that really did have to utilize that option, and that's just another quill that they won't be able to use, which is really unfortunate. On the other hand, we really shouldn't be doing that. Our teachers really, we should be respecting them a lot more than that. We say we value education, but on the other hand, we're going to lay off a teacher days before school starts. We really need to prioritize in this state. If we really believe education is important, then it has to be seen through our actions rather than rhetoric.
I think part of the argument here as well, though, Larry, is that many districts, she is right. The teachers say we're going to lay off. They've already did that. But the fact that it is a law that you can't do that, that, you know, if you're up against the wall, you can't do that, it can still be seen as a situation where the state is taking away part of the control from the districts.
Yeah, I believe so. What's happened is local school boards should be able to make those decisions based on local situations, and also the fact that funding is differential throughout the state. Christine and I are in areas where we get less money than the Bay Area, than Los Angeles, than San Diego per child from the state of California. So our situation is completely different, and we do need to have the flexibility to be able to make decisions that are good for our districts and our local situations. I think it's disappointing when you try to have a virtual budget. That's not what we have. We have very real lives. I would much rather be able to plan. Give us a two-year budget. The idea of every year in March trying to make a decision on which teachers get to stay based on a budget that we won't know for sure till sometime usually in July or later doesn't make any sense at all. It's probably a wonder how good the planning has been in school districts when we faced a situation that businesses don't face, and that is trying to make decisions with your hands tied behind your back in order to please a constituency at the state legislature that has no sense at all what's going on at local school districts. It doesn't make any sense, and we're not teaching our kids good lessons either when we do silly things at budgeting.
Superintendent Frazier, one portion of the bill says the option would be so that school districts cannot lay off teachers. They could shorten the school year. They could also cut transportation. And what would that mean in a district like Kern County when you bus so many, the vast majority of your students, to have to cut something like transportation?
Well, the reality is we would not cut transportation. The kids have to be brought to school. And you're right. I think in Fresno, as well as up and down the valley all the way to Kern, we do bus the majority of our kids. And so to cut transportation would not be an option. And so that means that we would have to look at other areas, and our classified staff, our bus drivers, those that are in the classroom and assisting our teachers, they would be cut, and that's really unfortunate. But that brings us to the question of reducing the school year, which really is something that we really have tried to avoid. I mean, we're looking at more instructional time for our kids, not less. But the reality is, for the first time, our school districts would be looking at that as an option. Reducing the year, for the first time, we've really looked at the quality of the instructional day, and there's a point in time where you just can't cut any more in terms of what you're providing the kids. And so you have to provide less days and keep the quality of the instruction. But that's absolutely the worst scenario, and we really hope we don't have to go there, but the chances are pretty good that we will.
But when it comes to, Larry, and you can answer this, but when it comes to this possibility that they've thrown out there that you could cut the school year, you also have to get the approval of the teachers' unions to be able to do that, because that would impact them and their salaries in a way. So in a way, you still have to have some kind of way to negotiate that.
Disneyland comes to mind, you know, Fantasyland. What happens is it's real easy for the state legislature to say, we want you to have the ability to cut the school year, but we're not going to allow you to do it unless you negotiate with those who are going to be negatively impacted by the cut. That doesn't make any sense at all. We have some interesting positions that some superintendents have taken, and that is this. The state of California has an affirmative obligation to provide funding for education under the Constitution in California. And they've said to me that one of the things they will consider is just run until the money runs out, and then the state has the obligation to continue educating. It will be interesting to see where that line might be crossed. And so instead of negotiating an end to the school year that's earlier, maybe they'll just continue to teach until there's no more money and then say, state, now you have to take over and pay it. And there may be a legal obligation for them to do so. So it's an interesting time in education. This is 41 years for me in the business, and I have never seen this kind of dysfunction at the state on a continuing level. We've been through the ups and downs and the valleys and the mountains in terms of financing and funding, but this is the first time that we've played virtual financing, and that doesn't make any sense at all. All of us understand. Tell me what I have. I'll plan on that, and we'll make the decisions we have to make. But don't play a game with me and say, okay, pretend you've got this much money, and we hope you make it. That doesn't make any sense.
Not a way to balance the budget, I guess. No. Also, in this bill, and it's something that directly impacts county superintendents, they have taken away your oversight responsibilities as far as being able to oversee the financial stability of some districts. We all know there have been some districts that have had financial problems, and county superintendents have had to step in.
Right.
Where does that leave you?
Well, Christine and I both serve with FICMAT, which is an agency that the state has put together that helps troubled districts that are in financial trouble. And there are probably well in excess of 150 districts that are in severe danger right now. And one of the things we have done so well in education is that we have had to look at not just this year's budget, but the 2 years after this as well. To take that away doesn't make any sense. I've got to tell you that the districts in Fresno County, by and large, have said to me, the superintendents, we're going to continue to plan as we always have because it makes sense. We're not going to play this game of Russian roulette and hopefully we'll be okay at the end of a devastating year. We're going to plan with the money we have. We're going to plan for the 2 years out anyway, even if the state doesn't require it. Now, while we may lose at the county superintendent level for 1 year the ability to do certain things in terms of stay and rescind and keeping a district from being able to spend themselves into debt or further into trouble, we're going to continue to work with our districts with advisories, much like we have in the past, that say be aware of the following kinds of things. Don't take chances with this. Continue to make your cuts in certain areas. Continue to plan. Make sure you're looking at your enrollment figures and your projections that are coming. When you have an opportunity not to hire somebody on a permanent basis, make sure you don't. Keep your options as flexible as possible. And so the advisories will continue to go out. It'll be up to each local board to make those final decisions. And I'm confident that our local boards, and I'm sure in Christine's area as well, the local boards will make the right decisions regardless of what the state suggests that they do in this virtual budget era that we live in.
Okay, I would like for you two just to hang on for a moment. I'm going to bring in Mr. Jesse Aguilar. He's an art teacher at East Bakersfield High School and also a representative with the California Teachers Association. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
You know, one thing, the CTA has come out in support of the bill preventing teacher layoffs, saying, you know, it will give teachers stability and a break from the constant layoffs. So you would say that many teachers support this whole idea and effort.
Yeah, I would say so. I think that I think teachers come at this from a different lens. I think being in the classroom every day and kind of seeing what less teachers do to the classroom is kind of shapes the lens that you see things through. When you have 40, 45, 50 kids in the classroom, there's not a whole lot of teaching that goes on, especially when those kids have language issues or special needs, and you have to differentiate the curriculum, and you have to kind of find a way to kind of teach what needs to be taught and get them to actually learn it. Each kid learns in a different way, and it's very difficult to kind of do that with a class that's really, really overcrowded. So more teacher layoffs would mean bigger class sizes, and I think to that, to teachers, that they really do see the impact of that.
Do you know really just how much teachers have endured over the last, let's say, 3 or 4 years with constant cuts coming every year, how many may have been laid off during this time?
Yeah, we believe that about 40,000 educators have been laid off over the past 4 years. You know, there's been $20 billion in cuts over the last 3 years. You know, and teachers have, you know, they've been laid off. They've taken pay cuts. You know, they've taken furlough days. They've had to pay more money out of their own pockets in order to make sure that the class, you know, continues. So, I mean, teachers have really been sacrificing over the last 3 years dramatically. I mean, this really is a state of emergency.
And then again, you've even heard, you know, the superintendents have talked about that. Many of them say that laying off a teacher as late as August is something none of them want to do and probably would not do. Because what is it? What can it do to a teacher?
Yeah, it just devastates the teacher, and it devastates the students too. I mean, I'm not only a teacher, but I do have kids in the school as well. I have a student in high school, one in middle school, and one in elementary. And, you know, it really makes it difficult when you think you know who your teacher is going to be, and then it turns out that that's not your teacher at all. And it does impact the students as well.
Just hang on just a moment, Jesse. Again, I just want to remind our listeners that our phone lines are open and you can join in the discussion. You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll free 1-800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. Another question, Mr. Aguilar. In this situation where the legislators have put in the budget there should be no teacher layoffs, if indeed school districts are faced with making another round of layoffs come mid-year, come December, what is it would teachers want them to look at when it comes to making those hard decisions and hard cuts?
Well, you know, a budget is basically a set of priorities, and I think one of the important aspects of this is that it is going to be bargained, and the legislation does have you know, there is the ability to shorten the school year. That's an option. There's other options that are out there as well, and I think the important part of this is, you know, I've heard a lot of discussion in regards to the bargaining aspect of this. But I think an important part of this is that teachers do have a different lens on this. I mean, I think when you pare education down to its essential sense, it's basically teachers teaching students, and that's the essence of public education. And I think teachers need to have a voice in that because they are reflecting what they see in the classroom every day. And I think that's an important part to this whole bargaining aspect. So, I also believe that, teachers, you hear teachers' unions talked about a lot, but when you really get down to what is a teachers' union, they're essentially teachers. They're employees of the district. And I don't think any teacher union or a person who's acting as a bargaining representative is going to do anything to harm the health of the district. So I think we're all in this together, and I think we approach this with that kind of idea, and we find resolution that meets each local need.
Again, Mr. Aguilar, how do teachers, or how do you think that the union would look at a shortened school year if that would become one of the options?
Well, no one likes the idea of a shortened school year. I mean, that's less pay for teachers, and it's less time to actually teach what needs to be taught. No one likes that. But at the same time, I mean, the whole notion that you're going to add more kids into a teacher's classroom, well, that just hurts the entire year in regards to teaching and learning. So, I think there's sacrifices that are going to have to be made if that happens. My understanding is that, the projections aren't rosy projections, and they're kind of realistic. I believe the Republicans as well as Democrats were using those projections during this whole budget negotiation. So, I believe a lot of this has kind of been. I understand the local decision making issue, and I think a lot of it has been kind of a lot of people are upset because of that. But I do believe that probably is an unlikelihood that'll happen. And if it does happen, I do believe that teachers and teachers unions and other unions and school boards will work together to find a resolution.
Okay, thank you very much, Jesse, for joining us, and we appreciate your opinions.
Thank you.
Again, getting back to the superintendents, what do you think we have to do to kind of resolve this issue once and for all? This has been going on for years. Every year, school districts faced with these difficult decisions and not knowing what to expect from the budget.
I think the biggest problem is the lack of planning that happens because you don't know how much money you're going to have. School districts have done an incredible job, and teachers have done remarkable things to give for kids. They've done above and beyond. Administrators have suffered tremendous cuts, which, when you take leadership out of the equation, it creates more issues for teachers and students and families as well. But what we have to do is we have to know how much money we have, and we have to make a real simple decision. What kind of California do we want to live in? And I think that's the question that all voters should ask themselves is, what kind of California do we want to live in? What do we want in the way of an education? What is a minimum amount of education that should be provided to every student in California? And when you answer that question, I think you come clearly to the point that we are not providing enough resources for our folks at K-12 to be able to do the job that the public expects us to do. Almost every poll that you look at also finds that the public overwhelmingly, and voters in particular, support education as the number one issue, even in the face of high unemployment and all of the negative factors dealing with poverty and all of those things. Your ticket out of poverty, your ticket out of difficult circumstances financially is a good education. So it's good for everybody when we have folks that get educated. So I would love to see a two-year planning process so I can plan for 2 years. Teachers aren't on this roller coaster of I'm in it out at March and I'm in again maybe in July. That's devastating to a family. They've got mortgages, they've got car payments, they've got everything going on. And it's very difficult for administrators to have to do that, to make those kinds of recommendations to school boards who end up making the decision for layoffs or no layoffs. Give us time And time is the greatest gift you could give us by telling us how much money we have. You will have that amount of money for X period of time, hopefully for a two-year period. And we will plan very well. And we'll also do the kinds of things we've been doing all along, but we'll ramp it up. And that's get businesses to step up and fill the gaps where the state of California does not help and does not provide the resources. So I would love to see a solid planning portion put together here where it says you're going to have X number of dollars for the next 2 years, and plan and do the very best you can. Hold us accountable, and we will do the job that the public asks.
I agree with Larry. The only thing that I would add is I think that the state of California really needs to prioritize. They need to budget honestly. There are going to have to be some tough choices made, and that's just the reality. We can't do everything for everyone. And we were hoping they would do that this budget cycle, really bite the bullet and make the tough choices. I know that there are good programs out there that would have to be cut, but the reality is that has to be done. It's not just about education. It's about the entire budget, and they need to prioritize and really decide what things they are not going to do. And I just want to add one more thing. Not only the devastation in terms of the dollars, but we are losing some of our youngest teachers. This is going to impact us for years, because those young teachers that are entering the field, they are the first ones that are being laid off. So we are not building that teacher workforce that's going to carry us through the next decade. And I think that is extremely sad. We absolutely need to take care of this, so that they do not leave the field. The chances are very good if they get laid off or do not get a job, they will not come back into education, and that will just be an impact that we will feel for years to come.
Okay. Thank you both for joining us this morning. Very interesting discussion, and one I'm sure will continue.
It will. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to the sounds from Arte America's Nights in the Plaza. That has become the entertainment venue for a lot of people in Fresno. It was that Friday night entertainment at Fresno Arte's America. As I mentioned, Gloria Verdugo was joining us in studio today. You know, it's not just the entertainment. It is the entire cultural arts experience that has made the center a very important part of the cultural arts district in Fresno.
Yes.
Why do you think that when you built the outdoor plaza, did you think Nights of the Plaza was going to become so popular?
Well, we knew we had an excellent idea. In other words, this idea that came along, and when we were offered this land, we realized the potential in it. And one of the things, needless to say, that any cultural center has as a goal, and that's to grow. So by buying the land, we realized that if we put a stage on it, we could, and then also a few other facilities, that we can definitely offer a broader range of cultural arts, entertainment, and that, of course, would be very inclusive. In other words, we could reach out to the community more.
You know, at a time when many local museums are struggling, why do you think Arte Americas is thriving?
Now, this may sound silly, but the truth is the volunteers. There is a real heart. There is a real vision for the arts, especially in the Latino community. And that's not saying that the rest of the community does not have the same vision or the desire. It's just that this center was brought together by a few people at the very beginning in the early 80s, and it was first known as Centro Bellas Artes. And then after that, it flourished to be this. But it has always been run by volunteers. We've had a few directors in the past that have actually have been paid as paid staff, but normally everything has been run by volunteers.
You know, but the Cultural Arts Center, just like many here in Fresno, did go through a rough patch. How did you get through that?
You know, again, people just hung in there. Seriously, they just hung in there with their donations, and it's kind of a difficult thing to answer because you don't want to say, oh, we're great, but there was such a desire and a vision, and possibly the vision, because it was very inclusive and it wasn't so focused on just one thing, possibly that helped because everyone just wanted it to be.
How important do you think the Cultural Arts Center is to sustaining, or Arte Americas is to sustaining the Cultural Arts District in downtown Fresno?
I think it's because it's been there. I mean, literally, it has just been there. It's something that people, even now, over the years, are surprised to see. The people that come to our Nights at the Plaza series every Friday night, many are new people, and they say, my goodness, we didn't know this was still here. And so they're surprised. So I believe it's been possibly part of the now foundation that exists in the downtown area and really legitimizes this whole vision for a cultural arts district in the downtown area.
Tell me a little bit about the partnership you have with the Fresno Arts Museum.
It's been wonderful. We have a permanent gallery there at Arte Americas that we share with the Fresno Art Museum. Beautiful, beautiful Mayan art, just wonderful stuff. So over the years, we have partnered with them through thick and thin, and it's just been great.
And what is your exhibit right now?
Well, in the galleries, as an example, one of the big exhibits is we were very fortunate to get from the Galería de la Raza, and that's part of the Mission District, San Francisco Mission District Arts Center, and it's called Su Arte Here. And what they've done is they've what they do is it's a digital mural project, and which was commissioned on that has invited over 50 artists. Now there's only 5 artists that are showing in Fresno, but this is a as they say, a moving or a traveling exhibit. And so one of the venues or places that they selected was Fresno. So that's in our main galleries, which is the Ruiz Gallery. And then, of course, we talked about the Fresno Arts Gallery, which is to the side of that. And
but
then,
you also provide opportunities for local artists
as
well.
And I was just getting to that. And that's the Upper Lobby Gallery, where we have that whole gallery is dedicated to young artists, local artists, as well as other artists outside of Fresno. But it is. It's a student gallery. We have a student gallery to the side of that. The main lobby, though, it is dedicated to complete exhibits of local artists.
And again, you listeners out there, we want to invite you to join in our discussion. Our phone lines are open at 559-275-8989 or toll free 1-800-224-8989. And you can also email us at talk@kbpr.org. Now, let's talk a little bit about Friday. They call it
the Friday nights. Friday
nights at the Plaza.
Yes.
We have that for you right now. So I think we want to go ahead and play you just a little bit of what you can expect when you go to Friday nights at the Plaza.
My name is Juan Gonzalez, and our group name is Descarga Latina.
Beautiful venue. It's outdoors. You can come in and just be by the stars. Right now there's a full moon, so you get to dance to the moon.
I'm not good at a dancer, but I'm trying to learn.
Actually, this is my first night with the band, and I know a couple of the guys, and they called me out. They need another trombone player. I'm loving it. It's a great night, beautiful weather, great crowd, good band, having a lot of fun.
Absolutely. It's a really a lot of fun. Good for the family. Good live music, dancing. You can't beat it on a Friday night.
So please come down and visit us and fall in love with the place.
Welcome to Dominica's, everybody. How's it? Is everybody having a good time? All right, ready for some more music.
Woo. See some dancers.
So it's a family venue as well. You can bring the entire family and come down and enjoy.
That particular night, which was Friday, because I'm there every Friday night, I'm the lucky one that gets to sell the tickets to everyone when the doors open at 7 o'clock. So I get to see all the faces that come into the plaza. It's exciting. And that night we had was called Descarga Latina was the name of the band. And Descarga in Spanish means jam session. In fact, it goes all the way back to the Cubans, because the Cubans were the originators of the Latin jazz as well as the jam sessions, as they call them now. So, yeah, it was very exciting.
Tell us, what do you have coming up for Friday nights at the plaza?
This Friday, we're going to have Z-Bop, and they've been to the plaza before. Each group brings their own followers or audience, but then there's more added to it. Now, Z-Bop is the music of Santana, and they are probably one
That's going to be big.
Yeah. Hey, let me tell you, they bring in a lot of people. We encourage people to come when they come to bring their own chairs, too, because lots of people, we obviously provide chairs, but lots of people, because we have the space, would rather bring their own chair. So we really do encourage that if that's what you like. But the music of Santana is always a huge hit, and they are truly, truly, how do you say, disciples of that sound.
And after that, now it goes through what period?
Yeah, actually, it goes all the way through September 30th, which is our very last night in the plazas, but it's also one of our biggest fundraisers of the year. Our Plaza series starts in May with the Mother's Day Festival, which is our very first fundraiser. After that, then it's just every Friday, a variety of, you know, of shows and events. But the very last day is September 30th, and that's Noche Tropical with Abel Solano, and it is awesome. What we do, instead of just chairs, we put out actual tables, so people buy the tables and the chairs, and as I said, it's a fundraiser. It's a terrific, tremendous show.
Wow.
And yeah.
That sounds great. What are some of the other, not just events, but plans for Arte Americas?
Well, people, very little it's known, but, you know, the facility, we do rent it out. And so we have weddings there. I mean, it's really quite amazing. So there's weddings. But then also there's other things that we had during the year. And that was we called the Nopal Festival. It's the first time we did the Nopal Festival on a Saturday during the day. Tremendous. We had different dishes of, that included nopales. Nopales, as you know, is cactus. And most people kind of think that's a little odd, but it's delicious.
Sounds like it.
Delicious, they say. But anyway, so we do things like that. And then also, I mean, the Irvine Foundation meets at Arte Americas. The Latin American Rotary Club meets there. I mean, there's a whole bunch of activity going on there all the time.
What kind of hours do you have?
The hours are, if I'm not mistaken, shame on me, but I'm almost sure in this, it's 11 to 4, Tuesdays to Sundays. We're closed on Mondays, Wednesdays. That's what it is. Wednesdays to Sundays. We're closed on Mondays and Tuesdays.
Does Arte Americas, do you participate in, I assume you participate in Art Hop as well?
All the time. Every Thursday, first Thursday, I believe, of every month, we have an Art Hop.
Is that the opportunity that you have for local artists to come through, or are your exhibits just open at that time?
No, our exhibits are open at that time. Now, but there are times when there are artists, of course, and I'm not quite sure how this is handled, but there are artists that are just premiered for that particular week of Art Hop. We've had, as an example, in the past, solo artists that come in and do there, as an example, if I'm not mistaken, his name is Fred Blanco, and I believe it was in March, he came in and did his very famous traveling show of Cesar Chavez, and he was premiered at an Art Hop as well as for the rest of the weekend.
And also,
I want to just mention that again, that the hours of Arte Americas, she said 11 to 5 Wednesday through Saturday.
11 to 4, I'm
11
sorry.
11 to 4 Wednesday through Saturday.
Through Sunday.
And you're also open on Sunday as
yes,
well.
Yes, the same hours, 11 to 4. So it's Wednesday through Sunday, 11 to 4.
Okay. And what is, you know, what we see this resurgence as far as what's going on in downtown Fresno, how do you think that's going to help with the arts community?
Well, outside of the obvious, I mean, through whether it's social media or general media, general marketing, you've got actual living that's happening there. In other words, we've got construction of apartment complexes, lofts. So you actually literally have more bodies, more people, more population. And if we can manage to, and you know, and I don't know if this is the right word, but capitalize on that, well, I think that's probably going to help not just us, but all the other, hopefully the whatever decides to go up around us in terms of other museums, cultural houses, etc.
You all think you're a draw for that?
For what exactly? For
other cultural arts venues.
Yes, you know, it's funny because, again, there's a lot of young people that are staying in these new apartment complexes in the downtown area. And, again, what they do is they walk around in the evenings and looking for something to do. And they just happen to come upon Arte Americas, and they come to these events that we have. Or anything, if we're open, they come in. I mean, so I think, yeah, we're important.
Gloria, thanks so much for coming in. And again, we want to remind people about Arte Americas. It's such a great venue, and we're very lucky to have you.
Oh,
and
no, it's my pleasure.
We're so glad that you're thriving.
Thank you. Well, you know, let's face it, we're thriving because we're willing to work so hard, but we're all, just like anything else, we're depending on the public to help us, donations, and I mean, I can go into a whole spiel about that. But
okay. I mean, and we should know that. Places like Artes Americas, you all don't survive without public
please,
support.
Please, if it weren't for people like Coe Calloway, the Irvine Foundation, I mean, there's just so many, we would not be able to survive, yes.
Okay. Thanks so much
for
coming in.
Juanita, it's been a pleasure.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. Your audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
Valley Public Radio, NPR for Central California, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield, and online at kvpr.org. Today's programming on FM 89 is provided in part by Marguerite McMenamin, wishing her husband Jerry a happy 25th anniversary. Good morning, I'm Christina Herrick, here with music until 11 o'clock when we have Talk of the Nation from NPR. So happy you're listening this morning, and our program includes Beethoven's Symphony No. 2 coming up after we hear this keyboard concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach. It's No. 5 in F minor. Angela Hewitt is the pianist with the Australian Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Richard Tognetti.